We're beginning here on the top of Lamed Hey Amud Aleph, about 10 lines down. The Gemara left off with the statement of Rav Huna, which was that Mashbin Oto Shua She'eno Birshuto, that we do demand that in the instance where the Shomer decides he wants to pay instead of taking a Shvu'ah, that we demand that he make a Shvu'ah that it's not in his possession. That we want to make sure that he didn't just desire the object, want to purchase it, and this is the way that he is going about purchasing it, which is simply saying that it was stolen, and then saying, I'll pay for it, and therefore he ends up with the object, and he's paid for it, and he feels that's fine, or he justifies that to himself. So in order to prevent such behavior, we make sure that he takes a shvuah, she'eno birshuto. Then we brought the question from the Braita where there was a loan extended on collateral, and then the collateral was lost, and there was disagreement between the malveh and the loveh, between the creditor and the debtor as to the value of the collateral. And there were two cases. The first set of cases is where the malveh, the creditor, says that the value of the collateral is less than the loan. And in one instance, the loveh denies completely that there was any differential. So he's a kofer bakol, doesn't have to take a shvuah. The other instance is modeh b'miktzat, and therefore he has to take a shvuah. In the second series, the loveh, the debtor, claims that the collateral was worth more than the loan. In one instance, the malveh, the creditor, completely denies it. Kofer bako, he doesn't take a shvuah. In the other instance, he is modeh b'miktzat, he takes a shvuah. The Gemara then says, based on that breita, the breita says, whoever the pikadon is, etzel, he's the one who takes the shvuah. That whoever has possession of the pikadon, or the mashkon in this instance, he's the one who takes the shvuah. It seems that we're afraid that the malveh will pull out the mashkon after the loveh takes the shvuah. But if you have the shvuah of Rav Huna, which says that he has to take a shvuah she'eno birshuto, what are we worried about? Him pulling out the mashkon after the debtor has taken a shvuah. He's already taken a shvuah that says, I don't have it in my possession. So this seems to indicate that there is no such shvuah, or that Rav Huna is not right. That there is no imposition of a shvuah on a person holding an object as a shomer in a case of a mashkon. He's also a shomer of sorts, and he doesn't have to take shvuah she'eno birshuto. So we had the first answer of Rava. Rava suggested that we have edim shenisrafa. The case here is that we have edim that it was burnt up, and therefore there's nothing to discuss about him pulling out the item. So therefore, you don't have to worry about taking a shvuah she'eno birshuto. But that also leads to the same problem. Then why do you need to flip the shvuah? If the item doesn't exist, then why does the loveh have to worry about the malveh pulling it out? Why do we switch the shvuah at all? El Amar Rav Yosef, so then we spoke about Rav Yosef, says it's a case that there were edim shenigneva. We have witnesses that it was stolen. So in that case, there is no need to take the shvuah she'eno birshuto, because it's clearly not birshuto. We have edim that it was stolen. But then, what's the issue with regards to him pulling it out on the loveh? It was also stolen. He can't pull it out. There, the Gemara answered that the malveh will make efforts to retrieve the object. And since he'll make efforts to retrieve the object, we're afraid that he'll pull it out on the loveh. Gemara says, why don't you say the same thing for the loveh? If the malveh takes the shvuah, maybe the loveh will go find the ganav, and then he'll pull it out. Gemara says there's a difference between the malveh and the loveh because it was stolen from the house of the malveh. So the malveh has some sense of who stole it. He knows who goes in and out of his house. He knows who knows about where these things are located. So he has at least a semblance of indication of who might have stolen the item. And therefore, if he pursues it, he might find it. The loveh is starting from scratch. He has no information at all. For him to go and then pull it out or try to find the ganav, much less likely. It's a chashash that we're not going to worry about. Therefore, if we flip the shvuah to the malveh, we don't have to worry about someone pulling out the item on him. Whereas if the loveh takes it, then we do have to worry about it. All right, so now we're up to Abaye's answer. Abaye Omer, Gezeira Shemi Yiton V'yomer Lo Achar Shvuah Mitzatia. The malveh can say, I'll take a shvuah she'eno birshuti. And then after he's taken the shvuah she'eno birshuti, he says, oh, I found it. So there's a fear here that that shvuah of saying she'eno birshuti won't cover us in this case. Because in that instance, if the loveh takes the shvuah, the malveh can still pull out the object and say, I wasn't lying. It wasn't in my possession when I took the shvuah. And now I found it. Now it's back in my possession. So the fear of him pulling it out of the loveh still exists, even after he takes a shvuah, she'eno birshuti, because he could still recover the item afterwards. Rav Ashi Amar, Zenishba, Vizenishba. Rav Ashi says Rav Huna's din is correct, and they both take a shvua, which is Zenishba, Shenu Bishuto, Vizenishba, Kamaya Shaveh. The Malveh takes a shvua that it's not in his possession. The Loveh takes the shvua of how much it was worth. Vehachi Kamar. But then why does the Braita suggest that you flip the shvua to the Malveh? Over here, we're not flipping the shvua. The shvua stays with the Loveh. Minishba tchila. That was the question. The question in the Braita is not who takes the shvua. The question is who takes the shvua first. Malveh nishba tchila. The Malveh takes his shvua first, so that if the Loveh took the shvua first, we have a fear or a possibility that the Malveh will pull it out on him and say, what are you talking about? Here it is, and it's not worth what you said. So what we do is we force the Malveh to first take his shvua, she'inu birshuto, so that way we know that he's not going to pull it out on the Loveh. Then the Loveh takes the shvua that's incumbent upon him, which is to say how much it is worth. But now we have Rav Huna's din embedded in the Braita, and the Braita is actually even addressing Rav Huna's din, which is, who takes the Shvua first? And the answer is Rav Huna's Shvua goes first, in order to protect against a scenario where the Loveh takes the Shvua and the Malveh pulls out the Mashkon on him. So, in that instance, it's not only not a problem for Rav Huna, it's actually supportive of Rav Huna, because the Braita is actually addressing the order of the Shvua, assuming that there is a Shvua, Shein b'shuto, and obviously Rav Ashi does not worry about the Abaye's chashash, which is that the Malveh will pull it out after he takes the shvua shein b'shuti. Now that could be for one of two reasons. That could either be he thinks that it's not shchiach when he takes the shvua shein b'shuti that he pulls it out afterwards. It's unlikely, or he might believe that shvua shein b'shuti is a shvua that a person takes when they really believe it's not in their possession whatsoever. So here, if he's going, oh, I found it and I pulled it out. Right, that shvua shenu b'shuti already covered that scenario, and therefore we're not going to see that type of behavior. All right, so now Rav Huna bar Tachlifa mishtmei de Rava Amar Reisha de Seifa Tiyufta de Rav Huna. The first case in the Seifa is a problem, a refutation of the position of Rav Huna. So again, we discussed the cases here. Where do we flip the shvua? The Gemara's assumption was that in the cases of the Reisha did with the cases where the creditor is the claimant, saying that the collateral was worth less than the value of the loan, and therefore he owed money to the creditor, and the debtor comes along in one case and denies it completely and says that the values were equal. In one case, he's modeh b'miksah. In that case, the loveh is the obligated party to take the shvua. In the second case, the obligated party is the Malveh, because the Loveh is the claimant, the debtor is the claimant, because he says that the collateral was worth more than the loan. And the denial is by the Malveh. So there, the Malveh, or the creditor, is the one that takes the Shvua, because he's the one either who's Kofer Bakol or Modeh B'Miktzat. So the Gemara already cleared up and said, the Seifa cases aren't relevant. The Malveh has already taken the Shvua there, so he's the one in possession of the Mashkon, and he's the one taking the Shvua, so you can't talk about a flipped Shvua there. Therefore, it must be in the case of the Reisha, where the debtor is the one taking the Shvua, that we flip it over to the creditor. So now, what Rav Huna bar Tachlifa, Mishmei de Rava, says, that even in the case where the Shvua sits with the Malveh, there's a question in Rav Huna. Because there, what's the case? Selahil b'tani alav, even in the Seifa case, where the Malveh is the one taking the Shvua, the creditor is the one taking the Shvua, still there's a problem for Rav Huna, which is, in this case, Sela Yivitani Alav, he says, I lent you money worth a Sela. Shtayim Ayashaveh. The debtor says it was worth two Sela. V'alomer lo'eloki Sela Yivitich Alav. I did lend you a Sela. Sela Ayashaveh. And it's only worth a Sela. Therefore, Patur, he's a Kofer Bakol. He doesn't have to say him. V'ita, the Rav Huna. If Rav Huna is right, in this case, where he's Kofer Bakol, there should still be a necessity for a shvua she'inu birshuti. His fact that he says it was worth a sela, and I lent you a sela, he's kofer bakol, in essence what he's saying is that he bought the item, the mashkon, with the value of the loan. The forgiven loan is now a purchase of the item, or in essence what he's doing is he's buying the mashkon. So why don't we have the same fear that we have with the shomer, which is that maybe he's justifying to himself buying the object because he wants the object, and he's offsetting the loan against the mashkon. So he should have to take a shvua, shein or bishuti. Fine. Let's assume he has to take a shvuah she'ena b'shuti. What Rav Huna bar Tachlifa points out now is, according to Rav Huna, who believes migo de mishtaba malveh she'enu b'shuto, that he has to take a shvuah that it's not in his possession, mishtaba nami a gilgul shvuah kama haya shaveh. He should then have to take a shvuah based on a gilgul shvuah, how much it was worth. So here, if you're already forcing him into a shvuah, which is that it's not in his possession, then even though he has no obligation about the value of the object, because he was a kofer bakol, but once you have him in a position of taking a shvuah, we could force him to take a relevant shvuah that is connected to the shvuah of she'enu b'shuti, even though he wouldn't otherwise be chayav. Independent of the shvuah, he wouldn't be chayav. But since we already have him in that position, let's have him take both shvuot. And that's the case. This is a refutation of Rav Huna's position because it sounds like there's no shvuah being taken. That's why by kofer bako he's completely potur from a shvuah, is because there's no reason to obligate him. You're right, mitzad adin, there's no reason to obligate him. But if Rav Huna's right, you could get him through a side door, which is that he's already taking a shvuah about she'enu b'shuti, have him take a shvuah about the shivayon, the value of the item. Samravashi, amrita l'shmaita kamei d'Rav Kahana. I said this over in front of Rav Kahana, va'amar li, and he said to me, tehei b'mamino. It's a case where he believes him. It's a case where the loveh, the debtor, puts his trust in the creditor. So he says, when the creditor says it was lost, I believe him, I trust him, I don't need a shvuah to corroborate that. V'nehemne loveh l'malveh nami baha. So then, why doesn't the loveh also trust him with the other issue, which is kamava shaveh, how much it was worth? Meaning the next case in the Braita, it says that if he's modav and mitzat, we make the creditor take a shvuah as to the value of the mashkon. Why don't we say that the loveh trusts him? If he trusts him that it got lost, he all can trust him about the value. Lokimle bigaveh. He doesn't know the object well enough. The loveh thinks in his mind, listen, his job was to watch it. He had the mashkon. That was his job. He was a shomer here. And I believe him. If he lost it, he lost it. I can trust him on that matter. With regards to the value of the object, the loveh says, listen, he just took it as collateral. He wasn't so particular about the exact value of it. He just wanted to make sure that it exceeded the value of his loan, or was at least worth the value of his loan, so that he was covered. But he didn't look at the particulars. He didn't investigate it so carefully. And therefore, he doesn't know it so well. I don't trust him to be discerning about the value, and therefore I will not allow him to get away without a shvuah. But then what does the shvuah help if he doesn't trust him about it? The answer is that once he takes the shvuah, the loveh believes that he'll come around to seeing his side of the story, which is that once he's forced or compelled to take a shvuah, he'll agree with the assessment of the loveh. So now the Gemara says, v'nemne malveh l'loveh. So now, if that is the case, then what about the reisha of the braita, where the loveh is the modav mikzat, and he has to take a shvuah? Why doesn't the malveh trust the loveh, dekimlei bigaveh, that he knows the value of the mashkon? If that's what the loveh is saying, that I know the value of the mashkon better, and truthfully, it makes sense, because it was his object that was taken, and that he should have a better sense of what the value is, so then why doesn't the malveh trust him? Lo mehemenlei. He doesn't trust him. Why is it that the debtor trusts the creditor with regards to his job, which is being a shomer of the mashkon, and he trusts him? And why is it that the creditor doesn't trust the debtor with regards to, quote-unquote, his job, which is knowing the value of the object? So Gemara says, the loveh is thinking about the malveh in the following terms, which is tumat yisharim tamchem. The innocence of the just will guide them. So that's from the word tumat, from the word tamim. So that the innocence of the yisharim, those that are just, tanchem, nechei, to guide or will lead them down a path. What he basically says, and Rashi explains this over here, that if a person is not neman v'yosherhu, if a person is not trustworthy and righteous, lo yimashrin oto min hashamayim, they wouldn't have given him the money min hashamayim. There is this view that if a person is wealthy, a Kodesh Baruch Hu must like something about this person, or there must be some good thing that they are doing. They must be trustworthy in some way, or there's reason to look up to a person who is wealthy. It's very interesting because the Gemara in other places speaks about this. In Ervin, Daf Pehe Amud Aleph, over there it says that Rabbi Mechabed Ashirim, that Rabbi used to give kavod to the Ashirim, and seemingly it's for the same reason, which is, it's not just that he was patronizing and he was looking for donations for the yeshiva. We know Rabbi was very wealthy himself and that he didn't need to solicit money from other people. So what was this idea that he was mechabed ashirim? Is exactly this concept, that if someone is wealthy, then there's reason to look up to them because the God is smiling on them. They must be doing something right. And even today, within the Sephardi communities, many times, there is this view that kavod is given to Ashirim, because again, the Ashirim are seen to be someone that Hashem is blessed for the good deeds or the manner by which they conduct themselves. Now, obviously, it's not always true, and one has to be discerning and careful about this, but this concept in general, the Loveh views himself as being someone who has to look up to the creditor because the creditor has been blessed, and therefore Hashem must trust him. So the Loveh, the debtor, says, I should trust him as well. Malveh mekayim beloveh. On the other hand, the Malveh looking at Loveh says, beselef bugdim yishadim, that when it comes to the corruption of the faithless, will despoil them. The idea being that someone who is not ne'eman to Hashem, or is doing something wrong, or Hashem is not smiling on, therefore they are found themselves in hard times or difficult situation. So the Malveh says about the Loveh, there must be something wrong with this individual. That's why he is in poverty or he's in a difficult situation. Now, in their day, lending money to individuals in general was not the way that we view it today. Today, people borrow money, even quote-unquote when they don't need the money, and they borrow it for everyday purchases in order to buy something that's larger or something that they can't afford that they can afford over time. In their day, most loans were involved, especially if you think about it within the Jewish nation where you cannot charge interest. Those loans were for complete necessity. These were people who could not put bread on their table. These are people who had nothing. And so therefore it was a form of tzedakah. They ask him why he lent him money. He lent him money because when you lend money without interest, in some senses it's tzedakah. And that's where the Torah views it, meaning that the Torah puts the parshia of lending money to those that are in need together with those that are impoverished. And therefore, the lending of money is another vehicle of tzedakah. And so that's how the Malveh views it. He is lending the money to the Loveh. But in terms of trust, and in terms of his view of the individual, he says this individual obviously did not act appropriately. That's why he's fallen on such hard times, or he's in desperate needs. And therefore, I'm giving him the money because that's the right thing to do. But that doesn't mean I'm going to trust him when it comes to the value of the item. It's very interesting, this view of the creditor-debtor relationship, that it's not only a relationship of lending and borrowing, but also they viewed it as a difference between the one who is b'derech Hashem and the one who is not b'derech Hashem. And therefore, the ashir, the creditor, gets much more credit in terms of his believability, his nemanut, and the way that people treat him, versus the debtor, who is the one who's borrowing and is in this desperate situation. He doesn't get that benefit of the doubt because of the fact that he's found himself in that situation. And you can see that leading to other differences in halacha. We generally say, quote the pasuk from Mishlei, which is that the Loveh is eved the ish Malveh, that the Loveh in essence becomes a enslaved to the Malveh. Again, a similar type of view of the relationship, as well as the idea of debtor's prison, which halacha doesn't recognize, but definitely was something that was common practice in their time. And we see that even in the Nevi'im, in the story of in Elisha, where the woman is being chased down by creditors, and they're about to take away her children because she hasn't paid down the debts. Again, the same idea that the creditor-debtor relationship is not an equal relationship. There's a completely uneven relationship. And that's also being described here in the Gemara about the view of who trusts whom in this situation. This does not account for Tzadik Viralo, Resha V'Tovlo. I think what it does is it looks at the majority, which it says that, yes, there are instances of Tzadik Viralo, there are instances of Resha V'Tovlo, but a la Rov, we can assume that people who were successful, Hashem is giving that success to them because of the deeds or the way that they have conducted themselves, or the way that Hashem believes they will conduct themselves. And the same is true in the vice versa. Now, again, it's not a perfect calculation, and I think it might be even in a improper calculation, because you can't really judge a person by their parnosa, which is people have things where they fall on bad luck, there's bad mazel, and there are things that happen in life that cause differences in people's lives that have nothing to do with directly with their behavior, especially if you believe that mizonot come under the rubric of mazel and not under the rubric of zchut and avera. So then it would also be very difficult, this view. But clearly here there is this view in the Gemara, and there are opposing views to this, but there's definitely a strong feeling of this, and it's still the case in society today. Al Gavra, the Afkid Kipe Gabei Chavre. This individual deposited Kipe, Rashi says are Nizamim, which could refer either nose rings, some sort of jewelry, nose rings, earrings that were deposited, others translated just as jewels, that they were just expensive items that he left with this friend. Amalei, so he says to him, Avli Kipai, give me back the items. The deposit, he wants them back. Amalei, lo yadana heichot vinum. I have no idea where I put them. Basically, he's saying, I don't know where they are. I have no idea. Or, in essence, they are lost. Ato the kamei de Rav Nachman. So he comes to Rav Nachman and says, what should we do here? Amalei, kol lo yadana pshiutahi. Anytime a person says, I don't know, that is considered to be negligence. And therefore, zil shlim. Go and pay him. You owe him the money. You said you don't know where they are. You're negligent. Therefore, you have to repay him. So now, in terms of what the meaning or the extent do we say this, is it really true anytime a person says, I don't know, that makes them negligent? So number one, it might be unique to the case of a shomer. The whole point or purpose of a shomer is to take care of it and to know where the item is. So when he says, I don't know where it is, then he's failed at his job, and therefore that is negligence. So that, first of all, might be unique to the case of a shomer. Number two is that a shomer has to take a shvuah. One of the shvuahs of shomrim is shalo pashava, that he wasn't negligent. Now the problem is, if he doesn't know what happened to them, then he can't take the shvuah shalo pashava. So that also might be what's driving over here, which is the reason he's chayav over here is because he can't take the shvuah shalo pashava. So his failure to take the shvuah to shomrim is actually what obligates him. Both of those would make it more unique or specific to the cases of Shomrim, which would make sense. Because you can't say anytime someone says Lo Yadana that it's a negligent response. Sometimes people just truthfully don't know. But in a case where you're either obligated to know, that is your job, or you need to take a shvuah as to what happened and you can't do that, that's what's going to obligate you in this case. And that's what Rav Nachman Paskins, Zil Shlimle, go and pay him for it. All right, so then, Lo Shilem. The individual didn't pay. So Azar Rav Nachman, Agve Lapadne Mine. Rav Nachman went ahead and seized his house, his ancient, his estate, up to the value of the Nizamim. He confiscated it in order to pay back the individual who had lost this money. Lesof Ishtakach Kipe. Suddenly, or at some point, he found the items that had been lost. But what interesting happened is that they went up in value. They appreciated in value in the interim. So Rav Nachman had assessed them at a given point in time and seized property to pay for them. Since that point in time, they've gone up in value. Amar Rav Nachman, Hadre Kipe the Marayu, Hadra Padna the Moro. Give the jewelry back to the original owner and give back the house or the estate to its original owner, and therefore we'll square everything out. Now, obviously, the person here whose house was confiscated may not be so interested in having this be returned. Because at this point, he'll actually make more money if he leaves the status quo. Because the property that was seized from him was based on the prior value. If he is now the owner of the Nizamim because of this exchange, then he might want to hold on to Nizamim, monetize them, and he'll end up with more money than he would have if he has to give it back, the Nizamim, and give back the Apadna. So he might not be so interested in the exchange. And that's what Rova says to Rav Nachman. Rova is a Talmid of Rav Nachman, and he's sitting in the court while Rav Nachman's giving this Psak Halacha. I'm Rova. Habyativna Kameda Rav Nachman. I was sitting in front of Nachman when this was going on. Upirkin Amafkid Hava. And we were learning Hamafkid, meaning that we were in this perek right now. We were dealing with Masechet Bava Metzia, this perek we were learning. Vamrile, and he says, I hinted to him a question. Shilem, Velo Ratza Lishava. Our Mishnah, which says that if the Shomer decides to pay and not take a Yishvua, Velo Hadarli. He didn't answer me. So now, what Rava is questioning is, we say that when the Shomer decides to purchase the item instead of taking a Shvua, he gets rights to the Kefel. He gets rights to the appreciation in the item. So now, the Shomer had a right in the Mishnah to take a Shvua and exempt himself from any obligations. Instead, he decides to pay. And in paying, he basically acquires the object, and he gets the upside in the object from there forward, or when there's Kefel, if the Ganav is found. So what Rova was hinting to Rav Nachman is, you already took care of the situation, and this individual opted not to pay, but rather have his property seized and pay for the items. Once he's paid for the items should be his, and he should be able to benefit from the upside in the items. V'shaber avid d'lo hadarli. He did not respond to me, but he was right in not responding to me. My time, exactly for the difference that you noted. Hotam lo atrachele lebeidina. Over there, he didn't cause him the difficulty or the duress to have to go to Beit Din to extract the money. Over here, he caused him to have to go to court, to have the property seized, and go through all this process in order to get his money. The difference being is that the Shomer basically preempts the situation and says, I'm going to pay you and alleviate all the problems. So therefore, he saves the other individual time, money, worry, all of that, and he doesn't have to go to Beit Din. For that reason, the counterparty is willing to give him the upside, or basically give him acquisition of the item, because of the fact that he saved him all the trouble. Whether it's because of what Rashi said yesterday, that he's now certain of getting his principal amount back, so he's willing to say, look, take it because I got my principal, or whether it's because of what the other Rishonim suggests, that there's a goodwill between the parties, and that goodwill generates the impetus for him to give him the upside. Over here, this guy denied it at first, then doesn't want to pay, then has to be dragged to court, then he has to have a property seizure in order to get the money. The Baalim here have no goodwill and have no reason to believe that he was going to pay the principal amount until it was seized. So why would they give him the upside in this situation? And so that's exactly what the difference is. Rava points out, I asked the question through a hint because we were learning the Perek. Rav Nachman doesn't answer me. But in the end, I realized myself that he was justified in not answering me because the cases are completely different. What Tosfot points out is that we saw an interesting case in Baba Kama. In Baba Kama, if the Shomer decides to take a Shvua, Shomer Chinam takes a Shvua to make himself Patur. So in that case, the Kefo and all the upside remains with the Baalim because he exempted himself with a Shvua. Then after he took a Shvua, the Shomer Chinam says, you know what? Even though I'm Patur, I want to be a nice guy, I'm going to pay you for it. Because I don't want you to be out the money. And he, after the fact, pays him after he took a Shvua. There, the Gemara says that the Kefil belongs to the Shomer. He has the right to it. Now, Tosfot says, you just told me the difference is whether you have to go to Beit Din or not. In that case, the Shomer took a Shvua in Beit Din. That means that he did drag the Baalim to Beit Din. And in the end, he gives him the upside. So what you have to say here is that the distinction is a little finer. And that's what Tosfot says over here. That over there, in the case where he causes him to have to go to Beit Din to get the Shvua, the Kanik Felo LaRova, Kishashile Machrei Kain, that's what Rova says in the Gemara Baba Kama, that if he pays afterwards voluntarily, he still gets the Kefel. Dahata Mishalem Birtsono. There he pays willingly. Avarav Nachman Utsvach LeGavot Apadno. So that's the real difference. The real difference is, does he pay voluntarily? Or does he have to go through a seizure, a property seizure, in order to get his money back? And that's clearly the tension between the cases. And in the case where it's all done voluntarily, then the owner is willing to give up the upside because he got paid out in the end. Correct. That does lend itself, or is it much easier to understand, under the position of goodwill. Although even according to Rashi, where he ends up with the principal, in the end, when he says, if I got my principal back, I'm happy. Although it took longer to get there, but he still has a certain amount of certainty in the principal. But in the case where you have to go to property seizure, there he's not going to give up the upside. The second thing that Tosafot notes over here, which is, didn't we say yesterday that there's a difference in the type of upside, the type of appreciation that happens? We said that if it's appreciation of the object itself, something that derives from the object itself, the Baalim don't give that up. If it is something exogenous, a windfall that comes from the outside, the Baalim are willing to give up that safek. And that's why the Gemara differentiated between wool, the shearings, and the milk, versus the case of kefel. The case of kefel, the balim are willing to give it up because it's a windfall, something totally separate from the animal. It might not happen, but something like the wool and the shearings and the chav is stuff that naturally happens with the animal and something that's directly connected to the animal's goof. That's how we described it yesterday. So Tosfot says, why don't we say the same thing over here? The appreciation of the value of the object here is something that's directly from the object itself. Why would the balim give up the upside? So what Tosafot answers is, he says that kipe have a shvacha da'alma. He says, no, that is considered to be exogenous value or a windfall. When you're looking at the object, you have the object. The object's for its beauty or for whatever value you have. The appreciation of the value of the object is not directly correlated to the object. It has to do with the marketplace on the outside and how the market perceives the object. And therefore, Tosafot makes the claim that here the appreciation is something that we would consider to be exogenous or a windfall rather than something that's directly correlated to the item itself. Because it's not a product of the item. It is simply a product of the marketplace and that relationship to the object itself. Right? So I was just thinking that when I was saying that, I think you could argue that if it was specifically bought for investment purposes, maybe in that case there would be a difference because then that is exactly why you have the object. So then you could argue that in that case. The other Rishonim argue that the reason over here that's not that way is because this is later in the process, which is that before when we spoke about that, we spoke about at the beginning of the Kinyan, what the Balim are willing to give up and what they're not willing to give up, what's the default scenario in their minds. But once you reach the threshold of paying for it, almost all the Rishonim, there are those that disagree still, some of the Magid Mishnah, I think, and the Rambam suggest otherwise, but most of the Rishonim believe that once the Shomer pays for it, everything belongs to him. I mean, not only does the Kefa belong to him, but so does the Gizot and the Chalav. I mean, that at that point, there's a full transition. And so you could argue over here that the same thing, which is that why he's talking about the Shvacha, the Kipe, even if you believe that that is something inherent to the object, the fact that he's already paid for it makes it his now. That idea of separating between types of appreciation is only before the Balim have actually been paid for it. But once they've been paid for it, at that point, the Balim give up everything on the upside because they've gotten their principal amount out. They've taken out their money. Rav Nachman is a Dayan Mumche, number one. And so Rav Nachman was, we saw this actually earlier in the Masechta, was very certain of his Psak. And he criticizes sometimes the Talmidim for speaking up and questioning him in a situation of a din. And he says, look, you can ask me after the case. Don't ask me in the middle of the case. Because I am very certain about my dinim. And we saw there before that Shmuel complimented Rav Nachman that his dinim were like Shvor Malka. They were like the decrees of a king or the different interpretation we saw in the Rishonim. So that's number one. Rav Nachman is very confident in his psak. Number two is he believes that asking during the time of a case might not be the right place or time to deal with the issue. So Rava raised the issue. So Rav Nachman dismisses it, doesn't answer him. Now, he might answer him after the fact, or Rav Nachman might have considered what Rava said and deemed it wasn't relevant to the case, and he moves on. But to have a whole diyun with the student in the middle of the case, he didn't feel was appropriate. That's what I assume why Rav Nachman did not answer him, and he would have answered him later, but Rava himself figured out what the problem was with his question. By the way, it's important in terms of conduct, which is that a student can ask a question, and that's fair game for the student to ask the question or to remind the Rebbe, maybe you need to think about this. Then once the Rebbe considers it, he does not have to answer the student right away. The student has to hold on and wait then. The Rebbe has heard it. He now has to accept what he has said. Then you have to move on, and he'll deal with you later. You don't interrupt, and then you don't force the issue at that point in time and argue back and forth about it. Again, it's an idea of proper conduct. It has to do, again, when someone's giving a shiur, when there's a psak halacha, the Rav is speaking from the podium. In Eretz Yisrael, it's more acceptable. I'm not sure why, but it's more acceptable to call out from the audience and question the speaker. Idea should be that you have a right to raise an issue, but then you have to back off, and that's it. But beyond that, you have to wait till afterwards to speak to the individual. Remember, the savor of Nachman, the Shuma Hadar. Wait a minute. So Rav Nachman believes that when you've assessed the property, Beit Din has seized it, that it goes back. I mean that you're allowed to reverse a seizure of Beit Din? Shani Hotam, Deshuma B'taut Havo. The whole seizure and the whole assessment was done by mistake. Dekahave Kipe Mi'ikara. because the items were here all along. Now Rashi, the way Rashi says this, he says, Sharei b'tchilat ha-shuma hayu nizamim b'yado. The items were in his hand from the beginning of the situation. V'lo ye yodeya. And he didn't know about it. D'ele ye yodeya shekein lo shamu lo atraklin. Had we known about this, then we never would have gone through with this. Aval shuma shebeitin shemin al she'en lo ma'ot v'chayav lo. In a case where it's done correctly and the seizure done appropriately, haru kemecher gamur v'enu chazeret. That's like a full-fledged transaction and it doesn't get reversed. That's the way Rashi describes it. The Rabbeinu Chananel over here says, Shuma b'taut avai, dahavu kipe, velo abdu. The kipe were never really lost. V'kaimelan, pikadon kohecha de'ite, b'shute de'more kai. And anywhere the item is, it's really in the possession of the original owner. Something that we've said many times, that no matter where the object is, if the guy owns it, he still owns it. It's not as if he doesn't own it just because it was lost. We just don't know where it is. So he's slightly different or more nuanced than Rashi. Rashi says that they were never lost. They were always here. Whereas the way that the Rabbeinu Chananel says is they weren't lost because of the fact that even when they were lost, they still were in the possession of the original owner. There are other Rishonim like the Ramban and the Rambam over here who even take this one step further and say, even if they were lost and then they are recovered, that still is Bita'ut, because of this Rabbeinu Chananel, which is that even when they were lost and then they're found, all along they were in the possession of the original owner, because the original owner never gives up possession of them. That means that they were always there, and therefore it's a Mekach Ta'ut. That's the idea here, that there was a mistake made and the seizure was done improperly. So now Gemara says, Amrei Naradai, this is something that we already learned together, Shuma Hadar Adresa Yarcheshato. Naradai believed that a Beit Din's assessment of property or seizure is returnable up to 12 months after the seizure is done. That the debtor or the obligated party has a right to buy back whatever was seized at the price that it was seized at for the next 12 months. So we give him a window of opportunity to recover the seized object. Vamara Meimar, Anami Narada Ana. Meimar says, I'm from Narada, Visvirali, and I believe, Shuma Hadar Liolam. That Shuma is always retrievable, meaning that the debtor or the obligated party here has a right to buy it back forever. Behilchata, and the halacha is, Shuma Hadar Leolam. That there is a right to reverse the seizure as long as you pay up the money forever. Mishom, Vasita HaYashar VeHatov. This is very interesting, because this is not necessarily quoting Lifnim Mishurat Adin, because we have other psukim for Lifnim Mishurat Adin. We already saw them back on Daf Chavdalet Amud Bet, where Tosfot discussed Lifnim Mishurat Adin. It does not bring this, which would make him sound more like Asita Yashar Vatov is Mi'ikar Adin. But over here, what does that mean that it's Mi'ikar Adin? So if you look at the Ramban al Torah on this pasuk of Asita Yashar Vatov, the Ramban on this pasuk does something similar to what he does with the pasuk of Kedoshim to you, which is that the Ramban in many places in the Torah believes that there are overarching ethics, morals that the Torah gives. And then the Torah specifies particulars, but then gives you an overarching idea that covers all of them. So for instance, Kedoshim to you is this overarching theme that one should act in a manner that is befitting someone who is Kadosh, that is holy. So what there he says is that don't be a Naval b'shut Torah. The Torah gives you certain halachot that tries to guide you on how to be holy. But even with those guidelines, you could still act in a manner that is naval b'shut Torah. The Ramban says the same thing about Sita Yashar V'atov. Sita Yashar V'atov means that you have to act justly and righteously with your neighbors and with other parties. The Torah gives you examples of that. But the Torah can't give you an example of every case between neighbors and every situation and circumstance will come up. So it gives you this overarching thing which says, Vasita Yashar Vatov. You want to know what the right way to handle these situations is? I've given you examples. The Torah lays out different circumstances and methods for dealing with it. But you want to know what the bottom line is? Vasita Yashar Vatov. Do that which is just and righteous. Act properly with other people. And so too over here, we know, and this is, the Gemara is going to say this in one second, but what we know is that the creditor over here has no interest in the property. The creditor didn't lend the money because of the property or because of the collateral. He lent money because he expected to get his money back. When the property is seized, then he's not getting exactly what he wanted. He got something in lieu of that. And what we say to him is, listen, if the guy comes back to you with the cash, that's what you wanted back anyway. So why not take the cash that you wanted back anyway and give this person or this poor guy his property back so that he can have what is rightfully his, in a sense, that was seized from him because he couldn't make good on his payments. And that's the idea of Asita Yashar V'Tov. That will mean, and again, the Gemara is going to say this in 1 second, which is that's only true if he doesn't monetize the property. He doesn't do something with the property that makes it irreversible, because we don't make him go and then undo years and years of transactions and things that happen afterwards. What we're saying is that where it's still in your possession and where it's easy to give it back to him, then in that situation, why not do the right thing and give it back to him and get your money? That's what you wanted anyway. And again, you'll have to assess investment and shevach and all the things that we've discussed before, but those are considerations to this. But that's the idea, I think, of Asita Yashar HaTov, that it may not even be Lifnei Mishurat HaDin, but it might be Meikar HaDin. That's the right thing to do. It's the proper way to behave in this situation. Although Tosafot clearly views this as being Lifnei Mishurat HaDin, because he says, why isn't that the second guy has to return it because of Asita Yashar HaTov? He says, because even the first individual doesn't have an obligation, min halacha, to return it. It's just that he is Asita Yashar HaTov. He's doing something nice. So therefore, when it already reaches the second party, we don't obligate him in Asita Yashar V'Tov because of the fact that he wasn't buying it for the cash value, he was buying it for the land value. So Tosfot clearly sees it as being a Lifnei Mishurat HaDin, vis-a-vis the possibility that we suggest that it maybe even is Mi'ikar HaDin. Pshita, Shamule the Baal Chov, V'Azul Ihu, V'Shamule Baal Chov Didei. So now they seize the property from A, give it to B. Then they assess the property, seize it from B, and give it to C, because they were debtors in a waterfall manner, meaning this is otherwise known as Shibuda de Rabbi Natan, which is the transitive property of borrowing, which is that B borrowed from C, and then A borrowed from B, and then the property is going back to C, meaning that they should be able to deal with each other because it should be see-through. And that's what the Gemara says. Aminilei lo adif at migavra da'ata binei. You, C, are no better than B. If B had the property, he would have to return it to A if he came up with the cash. So to you, C, if A comes up with the cash, you have to give it back to him because you're no better than the individual beforehand. Zavna, if he sold it. Urta, it was inherited. Ve'yava b'matana, or he gave it as a gift. Vadai, hani mi'ikara, adaita da'ara nachut. These individuals got it for the property value. Ve'lava date de'zuze nachut. They didn't go for the monetary means. So what the Gemara here is making a clear differentiation between is the creditor who's after cash, because that's what he lent cash, he expected cash back. The seizure is in lieu of that cash, and therefore there's a demand on him to return the property if the guy gives him the cash. On the other hand, if after that, the creditor sells the property and monetizes it, the person who purchased the property wasn't purchasing it for its monetary value, he's purchasing it because he wants the land. He wants either the production, he wants the appreciation, whatever it is that he wants from the land. Then you can't go say that the debtor has a right to go take it back from him, because that individual is already in a different category. That's what I'm saying here. This Asita Yashar V'Tov is a concept that where it's equal, meaning that you're not interested in the land, you're interested in the cash. Then we say, give him back the land and get your cash. But in a case where the person is really interested in the land, then we're not going to enforce a reversal of the situation. So those are the three circumstances. One circumstance is he sold it, because then the buying party is interested in the land. Or it's a Yerusha. The person inherits land from their parent, then we assume that they're looking at the land. They're not looking at the monetary value. The truth is that there are Rishonim over here, like the Ramban, who think that Yerusha, Urto over here, is not standard Yerusha, but a Matanat Shechid Meira. It's a gift from a Shechid Meira, which would then be very similar to V'yava B'matana, a regular Matana, a gift. When you give someone the property, you're not gifting them the monetary value, you're actually gifting them the property. The property, the person who received it sees property, he doesn't see cash. And so in all those cases, the debtor no longer has a right to retrieve the property for the cash, because then it's no longer Asita Yashar V'Tov, because then you're actually hurting the parties that have possession of the property, because they wanted the property, they weren't looking at it as a monetizable object, but rather just as property. The creditor, again, is in a different category because he looked for cash, and therefore this is in lieu of cash. Shamul Ali Isha. Now it's an interesting case. They assessed it for a woman, Vinciva, and then she got married. Oh, Shamul Mina, they confiscated property to Isha, Vinciva, and then she got married, Umeta, and then she passed away. So now the Baal, the husband, inherits his wife in this situation. So you have a situation where you have Nichsei Mulog of the Isha, and before she got married, she was a creditor, and she receives land as a creditor, but then she got married. The Baal eventually will inherit the land if his wife predeceases him, which is the case here. And now the Baal is in possession of the land. The other way around, too, if the land was seized for the woman, she was a debtor before she got married, the land was seized from her. She got married, passed away. Now the husband inherits her position in items or anything that belonged to her. In this case, what is the relationship between the debtor and creditor now? Because the Baal has now stepped in as the replacement for his wife. What is the relationship between the wife and the husband vis-a-vis the debtor or creditor in these situations? Is he seen as being memalei makom isha, that he's just stepping into her shoes? Therefore, is she able to act just like the woman, which means that if the debtor comes and wants his property back, he would have to disgorge it. Or the other way around, if the woman was the debtor and he has cash now, he can go and get the property back from the creditor. Is that the case or no? So Gemara answers, Baal b'nichse ishto lokeach chavi. A husband in the possessions of his wife has a din of a purchaser. Lo mehader v'lo mehadrin alei. Therefore, we do not return it to him, and he does not have to return it. He is the equivalent of what we said before, a buyer. Once a buyer shows up and buys the property, he's interested in the property, not the cash. The debtor has no longer has any rights to retrieve the property at that point. A husband is in that same situation. Now, what's interesting is that there's not Mi'ikar Adin. Mi'ikar Adin, a Baal is a Yoresh. He's an inheritor of his wife, which might put him under the category of Yerusha. That might be why Yerushonim, like the Ramban and others, explain that Yerusha is not really Yerusha, but rather it is a form of Matanat Shchiv Meira. Because in Yerusha, we view the person as filling in the shoes of the other party, and therefore maybe they're no different than the original party. So that's why Iikar Adin, if the Baal is a Yoresh over here, maybe everything would be intact. But, Dama Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina, Be'usha Yitkinu, in Usha there was a Takana, Hayisha Shemachra Minichsei Malog B'chayei Bala. A woman who sells out the Nichsei Malog while she is still alive, while her husband is still there, Umeita, and then she passes away, Habal Motzi Miyadu Kuchot. The Baal has a right then to go and take it away from the buyer. Remember that in Nichsei Malog that she brings into the marriage, the principal remains hers. The husband is entitled to the payroll, the production of those items during the time that they are married. So that means that they are basically joint owners of this property. She is the landlord. He is the leaseholder on the property. He gets all the production. He's like he's renting or leasing the land from her, and therefore he gets to do whatever he wants in terms of utilizing the land and the production of the land, but the underlying land belongs to her. So what does she do? She goes in and sells that land forward. While the husband's still alive, he has a lien on the property, which says that she can't sell it out because he has the rights to production. So she can't sell it for today because the production rights or the lease belongs to the Baal. But what you can do is say, if I pass away and then it's going to be freed up, the principal is going to be freed up, then it'll go to the buyers. What they were mitakin in Usha is that the husband has the first right of refusal because he is the first buyer of the wife's property. He is deemed to be the first buyer of the property, and therefore, even if there are subsequent buyers of the property, he can go and seize it because he says, I'm the first buyer here. That's the Takanat Usha. If he was simply a Yoresh, then a Yoresh has no way to block a sale to buyers. Buyers will have precedence then over a Yoresh because their rights precede that of the Yoresh. They bought it before the wife passed away, before the husband got any rights to the principal of the property. And therefore the sale would go through. So in Usha, they were mitakein that the husband is viewed as a buyer, and therefore his rights supersede any other buyers along the way. And therefore the Baal keeps the property. But because they established that the Baal is a lokeach, that has other ramifications, including this case here, which is that when he ends up at the property, it's as if it went from the original creditor-debtor over to a buyer. And therefore the debtor or creditor have no longer have any connection to the property, and we're done. He doesn't have to return it, or others don't have to return the property to him because of the change in relationship of him being a lokeach. But this is a Takanat Usha. It's where the Sanhedrin moved after Yavna was destroyed. They moved up to the Galil in Usha. And we have Takanat Usha that are found throughout the Gemara that are well known, meaning that they are very early Takanot, Takanot of the Tanaim, that the Amoraim are well versed in. And Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Chaminina is the one who actually, many times, is the one who brings down these Takanot Usha. And most of them deal with issues of husband, wife, family units, and property rights. Those are mostly the takanot of Usha, just trying to establish what are the proper mechanisms for ensuring a good society in which property rights and individuals are protected appropriately. So this is one of those takanot, but that takana has ramifications in terms of the Baal being considered a lokeach for other areas of halacha, including our area of halacha over here. Agve ihu b'chovo. So what we spoke about so far is a situation or a circumstance in which Beit Din seized the property. What happens in a situation where the debtor voluntarily gives up the property? The debtor says, listen, I don't have the money. Take the property in lieu of this. So now he didn't force him to go to court to seize the property. He gave it up voluntarily. So now, pligi ba ravacha ravina. Chadamar hadra, chadamar lo hadra. One of them says that you do get the right of return. And one of them says you don't have a right of return. Manda mar lo hadra, the one who says that you don't have a right of return is saver haizvine ma'alyahi. It is a full-fledged sale. Da'ami data denafshei agve. He gave it up voluntarily. He basically said to him, listen, I don't have the cash. I'm selling you the property in lieu of the debt that is outstanding. So we look at it as a transaction rather than a seizure of debt. And therefore, he doesn't have a right of retrieval because he sold the property. And that doesn't give him a right to redeem it at any time he wants. He only would have that right if we viewed it as a seizure. Manda Mar Hadra, the one who says it is returned, Savar, lo zvine ma'al yahu. He didn't really want to sell this property. V'hayda agve midate. Why did he volunteer to give it? V'lo ata ledina, and he doesn't show up in court and have it seized. Machmat kisufu d'agve. It's because he's too embarrassed. He doesn't want to have to go to court and have his property seized against his will and have this whole thing be publicized. So he does it in a nice manner and he does it voluntarily. I mean, you can understand this both from the perspective of the debtor saying to the creditor, look, you don't want to have to go through all this trouble. Why don't we just do this between us and I'll give you the property? So the fact that he's giving the property is not a full-fledged sale. He's basically saying, look, this is what I'm giving up because I have no other choice at this point in time. I'm compelled to do it. And that could be both because he doesn't have to go to Beit Din and be embarrassed and have a full-fledged seizure and auction of his property, but also from the perspective that he wants to be nice to the creditor. The creditor lent him money and he's unable to repay it. So he wants to do something nice and give him something to hold in the meantime. But in that case, you could argue that his sale, quote unquote, of the property is not really a true sale or a full-fledged sale. It's just that he's giving him a placeholder until he gets the cash that he can repay him and take it back. So for that reason, we have machloket amoraim as to whether the right of retrieval or to redeem the property exists where he voluntarily gives up the property. Now, if you believe like the Amora that you don't have a right of retrieval, this might give you an impetus or compel you to go through a seizure because you'd rather have the property seized because that would give you a right of redemption later on rather than giving it up voluntarily. So you might have unintended consequences from assuming that you don't have a right of retrieval where you voluntarily do it because in that case, then you're not going to have the right to redeem it. So the unintended consequence might, you might force things to court more often because a settlement outside of court won't give you the same rights as a seizure in court. I just think it's interesting that there might be these unintended consequences from that psak. Right now, me'emat achal pere. From what point in time does the creditor get rights to eat the fruits or the production of the land? In essence, what we're saying is that there's a seizure of the land by Beit Din. That seizure of the land then gives the land fully to the creditor at that point in time. Now, if the other individual comes and redeems it, fine. But at this point in time, it fully belongs to the creditor. Where is that threshold where it moves over fully to the creditor, and therefore all the production of the land belongs to him from that point forward, versus until that point it belongs to the debtor? So if it has fruits, it has wheat on the land, and it's harvested, who does that production belong to, and where's the threshold that it crosses over and becomes fully owned by the creditor? You know, when you buy a bond that is sold between interest payments, the person who buys it pays for the accrued interest. So the same thing here, a person who buys a field that is half mature with fruits, they're going to pay for the value, not just the field, they're going to pay for it with the fruits that are on the field. So you'll get paid out on that. That's not going to get lost here. If it's a week before the harvest, he's going to garner more money than simply if it was an empty field. The question is not about assessing the value, because the value will be captured in the price. The question is, where's the threshold in which the debtor is not entitled to any of that value anymore? So Mar says, Rabba Amar, Michi Machi Adrachta Liyadei. When the document of seizure reaches his hand, When Beit Din has waited the requisite 90 days to give the debtor the opportunity to come up with the cash to sell his land, to monetize it, or the buyer to come up with the cash to pay him, we saw in the Gemara already why we give him 90 days. And then Beit Din writes a document of seizure to seize property wherever he can find it from the Lovet. Once he's received that document, he becomes the owner of the property. Abaye Amar, Edav Bechatumav Zachin Lo. That we saw this earlier in the Masechta, that the signature of the Edim makes the document valid immediately. Now, the truth is over here, we're not talking about Edim, because this is a Maisa Beit Din. So it's using it in a manner of a paradigm, which is that once the document is signed, over here it's going to be signed by the Dayanim, that makes the document effective. So basically what he's saying is not when the document reaches the creditor, but rather as soon as Beit Din has signed the document becomes effective. Rav Amar, b'chishalimu le'mei achzrazta. No, it's only after the days of auction have passed. Meaning that once the property is seized, it has to go to auction. And once it's seized, then there's a process of auction that Beit Din goes through. They have to announce it. They have to publicize it. There's a process that's laid out. And then they can make a determination as to whether the item is sold or the creditor is willing to accept it at the highest price that is given there. So he gets the first right of refusal on the auction. But still, we have to go to auction. So Rova says the latest period, which is the point of time after the auction when we've assessed what the proper pricing is. Now, in terms of the order of how these positions are brought, this is the standard way you would find it. Rava is older and a Rebbe to both Abaye and Rava. And therefore, you would have Rava brought first. And then everywhere in Shas, Abaye is brought before Rava, even though the Halacha is like Rava in most cases. So anything about Machloket Abaye and Rava, Abaye's Shita is usually brought first, and then Rava's Shita is brought. So if I look at the order here, you brought Rava's opinion, then Abaye's opinion, and then Rava's opinion, that would make a lot of sense. The only problem is that Tosafot points out that there is a problem because the Gemara in Ketubot says that Rava asked the individual, where is your shtar adrachta? And basically implying that Rava thinks that the transition to the Malveh happens when he has a shtar adrachta, when he has the document of seizure. And the Gemara continues and asks questions on that. So Tosafot gives one answer. Yeah, he asks him for the document of seizure to know if they have already passed the days of auction. So he twists and turns to try to reconcile them. But the easiest way to reconcile it over here would to be flip Rava and Rava's positions. If you said Rava was the author of the position, Michiati Adrachta the Ode, that would be consistent with his position in Ketubot. And then Rava would have the position of Chishalome Yimei Achrazda. The problem with doing that is now that you don't have it in the order that they should have been quoted. Now you have Rava, Abaye, and Rava. It's just the opposite of what you would have expected in a normal case. Tosafot addresses that issue and says, no, that they are dealing with the time sequence. That they didn't bring them in the order that we normally find Rava, then Abaye and Rava, but rather, who's first? So the first thing would be the Shtar Adrachta, which would come before the Yimei Achrazta. The only problem with that thesis is that Abaye is in the middle. Rava is now the one saying that it's a Shtar Adrachta when it comes to his hand. Abaye says it's when it's signed. That's an earlier period. But Tosafot answers is because Abaye is all relative. Abaye says, no, don't say when it gets to his hand, but rather when it's signed. Abaye is really a response to the first position, which says that shtar adrachta is when it reaches the person, that's when it works. Abaye says, no, 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 it's not when it reaches him, it's when it was signed. So his statement, even though it's earlier, is really a response to the first answer. And based on that, Tosafot said that maybe you want to flip the girsa, and there were those that had a different girsa here, where Rava is the author of the first opinion, then Abaye, and then Rava would be the author of the latter position, and that would reconcile with the Gemara and Ketubot to make it easier to understand all of their position. Next Mishnah. A socher para michavero vihishila leacher. Someone rents a cow or an ox from his friend, then he lends it out to someone else, and then it dies in a natural death. Ishava hasocher shemeta kedarka. The socher will take a shvuah that it died a natural death. Vashuel yishalem the socher, and then the shuel is going to have to pay the socher. So let's think about this. A socher has an obligation either as a shomer chinam or as a shomer sachar. Over here it doesn't matter because if the animal dies a natural death, neither a shomer sachar nor a shomer chinam is responsible for that, and he is patur. So for the relationship of the socher to the owner, he owes him no money. On the other hand, a shoel is chayav in anything and everything except for meita machmat melacha. So here, when died a natural death, the shoel is on the hook for that. It's onus, but he's on the hook for that. And now he has to pay for it. So what ends up happening is, there are two relationships. There's a relationship of shoel to the socher, and then a relationship of the socher to the balim. The socher to the balim can discharge his obligation through a shvua. That's what he does. The shoel's obligation to the socher is one of payment. So now what will end up happening is the shoel will pay the socher, and the socher will then give a shvu'ah to the owner, and the owner will be out his money, and the socher actually will benefit and get money out of this. Which is what Rabbi Yossi says. Amar Rabbi Yossi, Keitzad halo usis chura biparato shel chaveiro. How can this guy be doing business with his friend's para? Elotaksor para lebalim. The money should go back to the original owners. All right, so let's take this in stages. First of all, why the Mishnah specifically uses a socher might be because of the nature of relationship. Someone who rents the object, he becomes like the owner of the object, and the idea being that he can really do with it anything he pleases. He's paying for the rental, therefore he has a right to lend it out, he has a right to do other things. And that might be why the Mishnah specifically picked a socher and no other shomer, because a socher has specific rights like that, which is, I'm renting it to utilize it like an owner. If I utilize it like an owner, that means both to lend it out, to do other things with it. That's number one. Number two is, why does Rabbi Yossi disagree? So the simplest way to understand why Rabbi Yossi disagrees is what Tosfot rejects, which is, Tosfot says over here, Ein lefaresh, mishum damalei maskir l'socher parati gabeich, da shuel shulem dameha. It's not because the owner says to the socher, listen, you have my para. There are two ways for you to have my para. One is that you actually physically have my para. Or the other way is that you got paid for my para. So you have the money that was in lieu of my para. Return me the money because you have that in lieu of the para. That would be the simplest way to read the Mishnah, which is basically there's a transitive property over here. It says that, look, if you're getting paid by the shoel because of the para, you should have to give me that money because you owe me a para. Tosfot says that's not the way to understand the machloket. Ela taima. He explains the machloket based on what we're going to see in the Gemara. There's going to be two positions in the Gemara. And basically what Tosfot says is the Chachamim and Rabbi Yossi are arguing these positions in the Mishnah. And he says, Taimed Rabbi Yossi avi mishum desaver desocher lukani elo bishvu'ah. That a socher only acquires the item through a shvu'ah. Umaskir yomarlo dalant v'dal shvu'ateich. You know what? I'm not interested in your shvu'ah, and I'm not interested in you taking this. Umashtena dina ba'de shvu'ah, and I'm going to go directly to the shoel. If the acquisition by the socher of the object is through the shvu'ah that he gives to the balim, the Balaam can say, listen, I'm not interested in your shvuah. I'll go deal with the shoel directly and I'll get my money. That's what Rabbi Yossi believes. And even if they're Eidim, what happens if they're Eidim that it died? So then the owner can say again, I'm not interested in you bringing the Eidim to me because I don't want that ownership to go to you. It's not going to help me. I'm going to go directly to the shoel and I'm going to deal with this shoel. So I am going to release you from having to bring Eidim so that it doesn't transfer to your ownership. That's what Rabbi Yossi believes. The Chachamim believe that a socher is koneh with the death. When the item dies, the socher becomes the owner of the item because of that responsibility. And therefore, the owner has no way to disown the socher from the item. The socher automatically gets the ownership of the animal as soon as it dies. And therefore, the chachamim believe it's now his. Now that it's his, he can give a shvuah to the original owners to discharge the obligation, and he can collect the money from the shoel. And that's what Tosafot says is the machloket here in the Mishnah, is when is that transference of ownership happen? And does the owner have a right to basically decline what the socher owes to him? And that's how they explain the machloket, which is actually going to be the next piece in the Gemara, is the machloket Amoraim, which is Amalei Rav Yehuda b'Avin l'Abaye. Michtes, socher b'may kani l'ay para. How does the socher come into possession of owning this para? He's only a renter now. How does he become the owner? Bishvuah. When he takes the shvuah to discharge his obligation, then he becomes the owner of the animal. B'neimelei maskir l'socher, so let the owners say to the renter, Dalant v'dal shvuateich. You get out of this case and take your shvuah. I'm not interested in it. V'ana mishtayin adina ba'de shoel. And I'll go deal directly with the shoel. I'm not interested in you. I'm not interested in your shvuah. I'm going to deal with the shoel directly. And therefore, I'm going to get my money back. Amalei misavart socher b'shvuahu de kakanila. But you made a mistake. Your premise is wrong. The socher does not come into possession of the object through the shvuah. He gets possession of the item, and it's his once it dies. Well, if it's his once he dies, why does he have to do anything for the balim? Why does he have to do anything for the owner? He's now the owner of the animal. The answer is, And the Shvua is just to make the Balabayit happy. And it's basically to calm him down and to say that he wasn't posheya, and that wasn't something that was wrong that was done here. But in terms of ownership, the socher is already the owner from the time of death, and now he's just taking a shvua in order to placate the owner of the animal. So again, this difference in the view of where that transition happens, Tosfot claims is actually the machloket between Rabbi Yossi and the Chachamim. And therefore, Tosfot concludes that Rabbi Yossi yodeh the Rabbanon. Rabbi Yossi will agree to the Rabbanon. He says, in a case that maskir atzmo ayasham b'shat shemeita b'yad shoel. If the owner was there when it died in the hands of the shoel, Rabbi Yossi yodeh. Rabbi Yossi will agree the divrei Rabbanon. Tahatam vaday kani lo b'mita greida. That for sure, there, mita causes the transfer in ownership to the socher. Tashkein ha-socher tzarich lasot klum. Because over there, the socher has no obligation of a shvua. The owner was there when it died. He saw it died a natural death. You don't need a deem anymore. You don't need a shvua anymore. So what's the only thing that can transfer ownership to the socher is the death. And so what Tosfot says, based on his setting up the machlok between the Chachamim and Rabbi Yossi in this way, is that if the maskir, if the owner was present at the death of the animal in the hands of the shoel, then the socher for sure gets to keep it, and even Rabbi Yossi will agree that the socher gets to keep the money, and it doesn't go back to the original owner. Right now, the Gemara continues. Amar Rav Zeira, pamim shabalim mishamim kama parot the socher. There are times where the owner actually ends up paying a number of cows, oxen, to the renter, which is obviously illogical or backwards. How could it be that the owner has to pay items to the socher? Hey chidami, what is this situation? Agra mine mea yome. He rented it from him for 100 days. The renter took it from the owner and rented it for 100 days. V'hadar shayla mine tishin yome. And then he borrowed it back for 90 days. The owner borrowed it back for 90 days. So now, the way that Rashi and Tosafot explain it is that they happened on the same day. That he rented that 100 days and then he borrows it back for 90 days. So that borrowing back for 90 days means at the end of the term, there are 10 days where the owner has to provide the rental para, because that's when his borrowing expires and the rental is still intact. The Ravid says that it's actually the front 10 days and it happened afterwards, but Rashi and Tosafot learn the other way around, that the 10 days are at the end. Number two is, Tosafot points out over here that it has to be a case where they're not of equal duration. Because if he rented it to him for 100 days and then borrows it back for 100 days, what Tosafot says is that basically annuls the transaction. The borrowing back for the 100 days basically says that we're taking back what happened over here. I have no obligations to you as a socher. That's basically what Tosafot says, and therefore that's why the Gemara does this in a stepped function, where there are days which the Sheila is not exactly like the Schira, and therefore the Schira remains intact because they're in excess of the days of Sheila. Hadar agra mine tamnan yomi, and then he rents it back to him for another 80 days. Hadar shayla mine shivin yomi, and then he borrows it back for 70 days. Umeita betoch yimei sheilata, and then it dies during the period of borrowing. So you have here a sequence of a rental for 100 days, a borrowing back for 90 days, a rental for 80 days, and a borrowing back for 70 days. That means that at the end of the period, he owes him basically 20 days of rental time to make up for the 10-day differential from the first rental situation and from the second rental situation. But he's also borrowed the animal back from him twice. Therefore, da kol sheila b'sheila michayev chadapara. On every borrowing, as a borrower, he's responsible for any death of the animal. Never he's going to have to pay him an animal for every time that he borrowed it. So he borrowed it twice, he's now chayav, twice to pay him for that. And to replace those two animals. Plus, in addition to that, he will have to provide a third animal for the rental time at the end. So he'll actually have to pay him two animals, plus give him a rental animal at the end. Now, the rental animal will only be with him for the 20 days and then be returned to the original owner. But in the end, he'll pay him two animals, plus have to give him a third animal to function as the rental animal. Amalei Ravacha midifti l'ravina michte chadaparahi. There's only one animal over here. I love afka, afka mischirut v'ayla l'sheila. Afka mischela v'ayla l'schirut. There's only one animal over here. Even though there are multiple transactions, there's only one object of those transactions. And that means that when he rented it, then he borrowed it. He borrowed it, then he rented it. All of those are about the same animal. The same animal is moving from one to one. You can't make multiple claims about the same animal. You have one claim here because there's one animal that's there. So he says to him, wait a minute. If the animal was alive, then you could say that. Because then there's one object that's here, and you could say the one object is the subject of all of the different transactions. Whether it's the borrowing or the renting, he is the singular subject. Therefore, there's only one animal. On the other hand, once the para already died, and now you can't bring that animal to bear, or the subject to bear in the situation, then each transaction breaks up into a separate entity or a separate transaction because the unifying object is now gone. And so now you have to deal with each situation or circumstance separately. He only has a claim for two parot over here. One for the borrowing that he has to pay him a para for the borrowing. And one for the rental time at the end. Shum sheila chati, because all of the borrowings are under one category. They are one type of relationship. Shum schirut achati, and all the rentals are one type of relationship. And therefore, the relationships or the multiple relationships are all aggregated into one, which is that as long as they're all the same type, the relationship, then since they were all about the same animal, we will aggregate them and say he only has one claim over here. The Sheila Kani, the Gamre, the animal that he gives him for the borrowing, he keeps, and the renter gets to keep, keeps that fully. The Schirut, Avad Ba Yimei Schirute, Yimadule the Mora. And with regards to the rental animal, he gives it to him for the period of time that he rented, and then the owner will get it back. And the main thesis of Rabbi Rav Ashi is really similar to what Rav Achami Difti said, which is that the obligations stem from a single object over here. And therefore, when you're talking about a single object, there can only be a singular obligation. You don't talk about it in some theoretical manner, which is, oh, I have multiple borrowings over here, therefore there are multiple obligations. You have to look at it, there's a single object, and therefore the obligations stem from that single object. Now, the way that Rashi explains Mar Bar Rav Ashi over here is that Mar Bar Rav Ashi is a similar position to Rav Achami Difti. He's basically taking Rav Achami Difti's shita and explaining why it's true and why the question of Rabbi Zeira is not valid. So Rashi sees the position of Rav Achami Difti and Mar Bar Rav Ashi being equal or being exactly the same. And he says here, Mar Rav Ashi svirle katkafta the Rav Achami Difti, because Mar Rav Ashi holds like the question that was posed by Rav Achami Difti. Just to note that there are others that believe that there is some difference between Rav Achami Difti and Mar Rav Ashi. But then you'd have to spend time on what exactly those nuances are or differences are between them. Okay, we're going to stop here by the last line on Lamed Hey, Amud Bet.